I'm Tracy Sable tonight on EWTN News Nightly. Loud and unclear. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson faces a crucial vote on the arrival of the members of the 119th Congress. We have the latest from Capitol Hill, paying their respects. As the President and First Lady announce plans to visit New Orleans, we hear how the Catholic community is recovering from the terror attack on New Year's. Some cold facts. One part of the United States is bracing for wintry weather this weekend. We'll tell you who should be prepared. Plus, a classical argument. Pope Francis releases his prayer intention for January, and it deals with school. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, the 119th Congress is officially in session, but it was not without drama. As expected, U.S. House Republicans narrowly reelected Speaker Mike Johnson, and that means House Republicans can move ahead with their new agenda. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reports. Eric.
Yes, that's right, Tracy. We expected a very close vote and lots of negotiating to get Speaker Mike Johnson over the finish line, and it did not disappoint. Surprisingly, it came down to just one vote, though. During that vote, 216 Republicans voted for Mike Johnson, and all 215 Democrats voted for Hakeem Jeffries, and three Republicans voted for other people. The three who voted for other people were Representatives Thomas Massie of Kentucky, Ralph Norman of South Carolina, and Keith Self of Texas. Johnson needed 218 votes to become the new Speaker of the House. After the votes, meeting took place on the floor and off the floor for about an hour. And then later, Congressman Norman and Self switched their votes and put Speaker Johnson over the top. Several conservative Republicans didn't vote at first, holding out for assurances from Speaker Johnson for changes in procedures. One of them was Congressman Andy Biggs from Arizona.
The concerns were and remain willingness to go to the Democrats to negotiate budgetary constraints. The entire budgetary cycle that was supposed to be 12 bills, which has not been 12 bills, the movement right into CRs, the promise not to bring CRs, those types of things that recurred over and over.
Did he give you any promises or assurances that that wouldn't happen?
I would say we negotiated and hopefully that type of stuff will end.
After the election, both leaders addressed the House. Hakeem Jeffries promised Democrats would not stop fighting for abortion rights. But first, Speaker Johnson read part of Thomas Jefferson's prayer for the nation from back in 1801.
Almighty God, who has given us this good land for our heritage, we humbly beseech thee that we may always prove ourselves a people mindful of thy favor and glad to do thy will. Bless our land with honorable ministry, sound learning, and pure manners.
And we will always defend a woman's freedom to make her own reproductive health care decisions. America promises one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. That's the America House Democrats will fight hard to preserve.
Over on the Senate side, a lot less drama. The new majority leader, John Thune, moved into his office today and then gave his first floor speech as the new leader.
Restoring the Senate as a place of discussion and deliberation. And that includes empowering committees, restoring regular order, and engaging in extended debate on the Senate floor where all members should have a chance to make their voices and the voices of their constituents heard.
Taking a closer look at the makeup of the 119th Congress, there are 63 new House members and 12 new senators, 150 Catholics now serving Congress, more Democrats than Republicans are holding office. On Monday, the full House will vote to officially certify presidential election results, paving the way for President-elect Donald Trump to be inaugurated on January 20th. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Eric. And joining us now to break this all down is Lisa Camuso Miller, Senior Vice President at Rock Solutions and host of the Friday Reporter podcast. Lisa, thanks so much for coming on. First off, your thoughts on how everything played out today. Tracy, thank you so much for having me. I think that this probably is the best possible outcome that we could have expected, right? This is a narrowly divided House of Representatives, and we already knew going into this debate that there was only going to be one defector. So the whole process and the way it worked was really, to me, one that it really demonstrates to the American people and to your listeners that this is a House that is serious about governing. It's going to be difficult. There's going to be lots of bumps along the way. But more than anything, they got the job done. They got it done on the first ballot. And now it's time to get to the work that the people elected them to do.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, there was one defector there. Let's talk about that. Like, some really strong opposition from Congressman Thomas Massie of Kentucky, who recently said there's no way that he was going to vote for Speaker Johnson, even if somebody pulled his fingernails out. Really strong words there. Ultimately, he ended up voting for House Majority Whip Tom Emmer. Talk to us more about that and why Massie just didn't get on board with Johnson.
You know, it seems to me like Congressman Massie was crystal clear in his voting and how he was going to vote. And look, he is elected by the people of his district. He felt as if that was the right call to make. He also, too, has said all along that he is going to be independent in his thinking. And so whether or not that is a good thing, it's a very difficult thing going into 2025, because with just a one seat majority in the House of Representatives, it's going to make it that much more difficult for really any policy to be made, because there is such a small, narrow division. And it's crystal clear that Republicans and Democrats are going to do their very best not to work together.
Yeah, and we know there were two representatives who flipped, Ralph Norman and Keith Self. They ended up changing their vote, and they voted against Johnson second round. What caused them to switch their votes?
There's no question. When we saw that there were at least a half a dozen members that held their vote and decided not to make their wishes known in the first go around, which you obviously, if you watched, Tracy, I know you saw this too, there was a lot of moving around. But I think ultimately they all came around to the idea that Mike Johnson has the best interest at heart. He also very much has a lot of the ear of the conference. So over 200 of the Republicans stepped up and supported him, with just a handful that were dissenting from that. It's interesting to me that, and goes to show that in spite of the fact that this is a very narrow majority, he will be effective as the next Speaker of the House.
Yeah. One thing I want to talk about quickly before we wrap is how important it was to get Johnson elected today. I mean, what would have happened if we had to go a few more rounds and this process was dragged out?
Well, I think we saw it happen the last time we elected a speaker, when Kevin McCarthy was in this fight. The longer time goes, the more there are people that say, well, maybe I should speak up and maybe I should have something else to say about this. It doesn't become more about the candidate or less about the candidate. It becomes more about what it is they can get in the negotiating process. And so time was absolutely short. Time was on the hands and in the favor of this new speaker, second term for him, and one that I think will be, as I said, successful because it was, in fact, a one ballot and a fast turnaround within the hour or so-ish. Well, maybe more than that. But otherwise, it was a good statement and a good step in the right direction.
Alisa, thanks so much. Great to get your insights today. We appreciate it. Well, the White House says that President Joe Biden and the First Lady will visit New Orleans on Monday to grieve with the families and community members impacted by the deadly terror attack. And tonight, federal authorities are worried about potential copycat cases, so they are encouraging and advising state and local officials to be aware and vigilant. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Tracy, it was the deadliest ISIS-inspired assault on the U.S. in years. And in addition to concerns over potential copycats, federal officials also warn of a resurgent international terrorism threat.
As New Orleans begins to heal, inching back to normalcy, today in the Oval Office, when asked if he's spoken with the families of the victims of the attack, President Biden confirming,
"Yes, I have."
14 people killed when an Army veteran plowed a pickup truck into revelers in the attack along Bourbon Street. As for concerns about security surrounding upcoming big events, including the inauguration,
the Department of Homeland Security and federal law enforcement have well-established safety and security protocols in place, especially as we speak to the inauguration, obviously.
Tonight, the FBI continues to hunt for clues about the attacker, telling the public it has set up a digital media tip line. Anyone with information, photos, and/or video footage of the incident, Jabbar, or the two coolers containing IEDs should submit them. The FBI says the attacker was inspired by the Islamic State militant group, or ISIS. The U.S. military has been hunting down ISIS in the Middle East.
ISIS retains capabilities, as we've seen in Iraq and Syria, and that's why we have our forces in both of those countries to ensure that ISIS can never reconstitute or resurge or surge back to what it was, you know, just a decade ago.
Meanwhile, more stories coming out about the lives lost, including Tiger Besh. Today, his former high school coach calling Besh one of the best athletes he'd ever seen.
I mean, Tiger could do things on a football field that would just blow you away. But Tiger was so much more than that, which I think is the reason that there's so much pain and suffering right now and a lot of hurt in our community, because Tiger was so deep. And Tiger was loyal, was charismatic, had some great friendships, loved coming back to his school.
Also tonight, questions remain about the highly decorated Army soldier who shot himself in that Tesla Cybertruck packed with fireworks that blew up outside Donald Trump's hotel in Las Vegas. It's not clear why he chose that vehicle and hotel. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
And for more, we turn now to Monsignor Christopher Nolte from the Good Shepherd Parish and the Basilica of St. Stephen in New Orleans. He and his family have been in New Orleans for generations. Monsignor, great to be with you today. And we are so sorry for all that you've experienced, everyone in New Orleans, and we're praying for you all there right now. What is the mood like in New Orleans?
You know, I think the mood on Wednesday, right after it happened, was a real tremendous amount of shock. You hear it, you know, I obviously came up on my phone when I got up early that morning for Mass. And then there was a sense of nervousness in the city that this wasn't the only thing that was going to happen. So there's a real sense of shock on Wednesday. Fortunately for us, for many people in the world, Wednesday was just, you know, the New Year's Day. For us, it was the solemnity of Mary, Mother of God. So a start of the day with two Masses. You know, we didn't know the whole picture of anything, but obviously we prayed for all of those victims and the families and the consolation of the families of the victims. And then the rest of the day was kind of crazy because you're hearing all kinds of things on the news. I have two friends who are in law enforcement. One is ex-military and one is an expert on terrorism. And both of them told me, do not go downtown today.
Sadly, 14 people died and two young Catholic men died. Let's talk a little bit more about that and how the Catholic community is kind of rallying around their family and friends and their peers during this time.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the cathedral, that's its parish. So the archbishop has really taken the lead. That's his parish. That's where his cathedra, his bishop's chair is. And so he's really been out in front. But both of these young men come from other strong faith communities. I'm connected to one of them who is very close to the boy, Tiger Besh, who passed away. And he immediately went over to the family's house and brought them food. The people in the hospital kept him alive until his parents could get there. He received holy anointing, thank God. And then they had prayer vigils at his parish.
And Monsignor, talk to us about that, how important our Catholic faith is during times like this, when you really can't make sense of senseless acts like this.
No, and, you know, New Orleans is still in so many ways a very Catholic place. It's sure the people are Catholic, but we celebrate a lot of holidays that people don't celebrate that are Catholic. I mean, you know, on Monday is January 6th, the Epiphany. Some people just don't mark it. Well, it begins king cake season for us, reminds us of the Magi. And then it king cake season goes all the way through Mardi Gras. And then at midnight on Mardi Gras Day, the police go down Bourbon Street, clear the street, and say, Mardi Gras is over. It's time for Lent. Catholics, many of the Catholics I know, we don't eat fish, we don't eat meat on Fridays. It's a recognition. But the Catholic Church is strongest in each of the individual parishes. We have a great presbyterate in New Orleans, great, wonderful holy priests, and amazing lay volunteers who work to serve. And it's in service that they encounter Jesus and the poor. They're also providing light to those people who are being served, the homeless. And we three times a month, my parish goes and serves food to the poor. And they come back grace-filled, because whatever you do for the least of my brothers, you do for me.
We're going to continue to pray for all of you in New Orleans. Monsignor Rinaldi, thank you so much for your time today. God bless you.
Bless you.
Well, in other news, an extraordinary use of executive power. President Biden has blocked the nearly $15 billion takeover of U.S. Steel by a Japanese company. In a statement today, the president wrote, "We need major U.S. companies representing the major share of U.S. steelmaking capacity to keep leading the fight on behalf of America's national interests." As a committee of national security and trade experts across the executive branch determined, this acquisition would place one of America's largest steel producers under foreign control and create risk for our national security and our critical supply chains. Both Nippon and U.S. Steel slammed the president's decision, saying that it was unlawful, while the head of the United Steelworkers Union praised the move and what it called Biden's lifelong commitment to American workers. Our President Biden gives a prestigious White House award to 20 people, including two same-sex marriage supporters and an abortion activist. The Presidential Citizens Medal is one of the highest civilian awards that an American can receive. Recipients included Mary Bonanno and Evan Wolfson, lawyers who argued in favor of same-sex marriage. Also honored was Eleanor Schmiel. She led the first national abortion rights march back in 1986. Well, New York judges ordered President-elect Donald Trump to be sentenced on January 10th in his hush money case. Judge Juan Merchan wrote in the decision that he will not jail the president-elect. He indicated that he would sentence him to a conditional discharge in which a case gets dismissed if a defendant avoids rearrest. Trump was convicted of 34 counts of falsifying business records in May of 2024. All right, now to the Middle East, where at least 30 people are dead following Israeli airstrikes in central Gaza. According to reports, the strike targeted several buildings, including a hospital. Officials say the dead include women and children. The Israeli military says that it was targeting Hamas command centers. This comes as Yemen is accused of firing missiles into central Israel. There were no immediate reports of injuries. All this comes amid hopes of rekindling stalled talks for a ceasefire. South Korean investigators have left the residence of the impeached president after a six-hour standoff to try and detain him. Outside his residence, groups of President Yoon Suk-yeol's supporters vowed to protect him. South Korea's anti-corruption agency says that it would be nearly impossible to detain the president while he is protected by the Presidential Security Service. An arrest warrant on the impeached leader was issued earlier this week, and his presidential powers have been suspended following the impeachment. The last time President Yoon is known to have left his residence was on December 12th. That, there's a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including message on a bottle, the link between alcohol and cancer, and what the U.S. Surgeon General wants you to know. And Father Mike Schmitz takes the stage in Salt Lake City, the special message that he had for thousands of young Catholics. Eastern United States is bracing for cold temperatures as a polar vortex storms in over the weekend. Temperatures along the East Coast are expected to drop below average for the first half of January. Gulf Coast states and Florida could also experience colder than usual weather. Heavy snow and cold winds are expected from the Great Lakes to the Appalachians, so bundle up and stay warm. And if you like a hot toddy to keep you warm, you may want to rethink that. That's because the U.S. Surgeon General is calling for cancer warnings on alcohol. Dr. Vivek Murthy says alcohol consumption is responsible for about 100,000 preventable cases of cancer a year and 20,000 alcohol-related cancer deaths. The advisory issued today would require an act of Congress to change the existing warning labels on bottles of beer, wine, and liquor. They all discuss the risk of alcohol in pregnancy and intoxicated driving, but not cancer. After almost two decades, the fight for broadband internet to be treated as essential service like water or electricity has come to an end. In a landmark decision, the U.S. Appeals Court for the Sixth Circuit struck down the Federal Communications Commission's net neutrality rules. The ruling stated the FCC did not have the authority to stop telecommunications companies from blocking or slowing access to Internet content. And for more, I want to bring in Brent Skorup, legal fellow at the Cato Institute. Brent, great to be with you today. Net neutrality is basically about equal Internet access. So explain to us what happens when the net neutrality rules are lifted.
Sure. I expect your average internet user will not see much of a difference. The net neutrality rules, what it really is giving the federal government broad authority to regulate the internet. And this is something that Congress did not want the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, did not want the Federal Communications Commission to have this broad authority over the internet. And the FCC has fought for several years to regulate internet companies, like you said, like common carriers, like the old AT&T monopoly and airlines and so on. But as the Sixth Circuit said, the FCC doesn't have that authority.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, not a lot of changes for consumers, but anything else for us to think of when it comes to this?
This has been a long-term debate about what powers the government should have over media distribution. Some viewers might remember the fights about the Fairness Doctrine and regulating broadcast radio and TV in the past. And so I was gratified to see the Sixth Circuit strike down the FCC's attempt to bring these legacy regulations to the internet. I think it distracted a lot of people, and particularly our regulators. They could have been doing things that would benefit the average person, like expanding broadband into rural areas, improving the subsidy programs. But they've been caught in this net neutrality debate for a long time, and I think it's harmed the agency and its priorities as well as consumers.
Brent, in their opinion, the three-judge panel cited a Supreme Court decision in June known as Loper-Bright. Can you tell us a little bit more about that case and how that connects to net neutrality?
So Loper-Bright was a transformative decision by the Supreme Court in that it overruled a previous Supreme Court decision, which the Supreme Court doesn't do often, a case called Chevron. And the case called Chevron in the 80s, the Supreme Court said, we're going to defer to agencies when they interpret a statute from Congress. We're going to give an agency a lot of deference when they're interpreting a statute. This case, this net neutrality issue came up because this is ping-ponged for over 20 years between administrations where the FCC imposes strict regulations on internet companies, and then a Republican administration comes in and repeals those strict regulations, and it's gone like that for a while. Supreme Court, in a related case, said that this gives companies no predictability. You can have this whiplash effect as administrations change, and so we're not going to give this deference to agencies. Congress needs to write statutes more clearly if they want agencies to enforce them. We're not just going to give agencies a lot of self-interested agencies a lot of power. And so the court yesterday in the net neutrality case, as you said, cited this Loper-Bright decision where the Supreme Court said no longer will agencies get deference. Courts We'll have to interpret the statutes in the first instance, not the agency.
All right. Well, Brent, thank you so much for weighing in. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a classy request why the Holy Father's prayer intention this month deals with school, plus some good news for two members of the EWTN Vatican team. Of the SEEK conference happening in Salt Lake City and in Washington, D.C. Thousands of young adult Catholics are attending the event, which is meant to edify and encourage everyone to live their Catholic faith boldly and joyfully. Father Mike Schmidt spoke at the conference and reminded everyone that what we desire most in this life is to be united with God.
In our culture, there is this dichotomy between, hey, listen, it's not about religion, it's about relationship. Anyone heard that? Not about religion, about relationship. That is a false dichotomy. Why? Many reasons, but here's one. Because sin is to sunder, right? It's to split. It's to be divided. It's to be splintered. The word religion comes from the word religare, which means to bind up. My heart has been splintered. So I need my heart to be bound up again. Every temptation, the heart of every sin, is an attempt to be happy apart from God. My biggest temptation, I'm prone to run away. God, here's what I say to God more than anything else. Leave me alone. Here's what we say to God, maybe some of us more than anything else. God, just leave me alone. So I need religion. I need to be bound back to him. I need to say, God, please bind me to you.
And it can follow all that Seek 25 has to offer right here on EWTN. We'll broadcast the major events live through the weekend, so you will not miss out on anything. Tune in. Pope Francis is calling attention to the fact that some 250 million children worldwide are not attending school.
Una catástrofe educativa. Y no es exageración.
In his prayer attention for January, the Holy Father defends the right to an education for children and young people, something made difficult by war and migration. He adds that education is a hope for everyone because it can save people from discrimination, criminal networks, and exploitation. Well, finally tonight, we end the week with some wonderful news from our EWTN Vatican Bureau. Earlier this week, longtime EWTN foreign correspondent Colin Flynn married colleague Paula Araza, Vatican correspondent for EWTN Noticias. They were married in Innes County Clare in Ireland, with Colm calling it the happiest day of his life. Congratulations to the beautiful couple, and may God bless them in their new life together. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.